This is Brother Peter Diamond, VaticanCatholic.com. I was going to be discussing the book called An Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine by Cardinal John Henry Newman. I wanted to talk about some of the more interesting and important quotes and points that can be found in this book. Why is this book by Cardinal John Henry Newman important? Well, as some of our readers know, Cardinal Newman was a famous so-called convert in the 19th century from Anglicanism to Catholicism, and he was an extremely influential intellectual. And the topic of this book, the, quote, development of Christian doctrine, is an important concept to many modernists who use this concept in an attempt to justify the doctrinal novelties that we've seen after Vatican II. And in fact, in the foreword to this edition of the book, the foreword was written by Ian Kerr. It praises this essay, which is really a book, it's over 400 pages, and it says that it is, quote, a classic text for the theology of the development of doctrine, a branch of theology which has become especially important in the ecumenical era, end quote. And so they attempt to use this idea that there is a development of doctrine, which they think that Newman explained so brilliantly, to justify the modernization of Catholic thought, the novelties that we've seen, the false ecumenism, etc. So it's a very important issue in that sense, and Cardinal Newman, John Henry Newman, is also on his way to being, quote, beatified by the Vatican II sect. I believe that Benedict XVI plans to, quote, beatify him this fall. And so I want to talk about this book, and I want to talk about the positive and the negative aspects of it, because there are many interesting and positive parts of what he's written, in addition to, unfortunately, many passages which are simply incompatible with Catholic teaching and how a Catholic is bound to understand Catholic dogma. And so in this part, I'll probably be focusing on some of the more interesting quotes from a positive standpoint, because despite the problems I will discuss, this John Henry Newman was an incredibly learned man who brings out a lot of very interesting things. And I guess the first quote I want to look at comes from page 127, and it has to do with the baptism issue. And a while back I did two audio videos on the issue of unbaptized catechumens and the delay for baptism, and I refuted the objections that unfortunately advocates of baptism of desire make, that because in certain parts of the early church there was a delay for baptizing catechumens, there would be certain periods where they would wait. That was because the church believed they could be saved without baptism, and I went through the evidence which refuted that and showed that that is not the case at all, that the delay is not from apostolic tradition as we see in the Acts of the Apostles and other things, and that it was not because the church taught or believed that they could be saved without baptism. And I gave the example of Pope St. Siricius, who observed the delay, but also taught that they cannot be saved, even if they die desiring baptism and don't get it. But it's interesting that on page 127 of his book, An Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine, Newman discusses this delay. And he says, quote, as is well known, it was not unusual in that age of the church for those who might be considered catechumens to delay their baptism, as Protestants now delay reception of the Holy Eucharist. It is difficult for us at this day to enter into the assemblage of motives which led to this postponement, to a keen sense and awe of the special privileges of baptism, which could only once be received. Other reasons would be added, reluctance to being committed to a strict rule of life, and to making a public profession of religion, and to joining in a specially intimate fellowship or solidarity with strangers. But so it was, in matter of fact, for reasons good or bad, that infant baptism, which is a fundamental rule of Christian duty with us, was less earnestly insisted on in early times. End quote. And so what he's saying here is that It is difficult for us at this day to analyze what the motives might have been for them to delay these baptisms, as happened in certain cases. Well, if it was because it was believed they could be saved without it, he would have just said that. He doesn't. He says, he gives a list of reasons which could have led to the decision to do that. A sense of the awe and privileges of baptism which could only be received once, reluctance to being committed to the strict rule of life, etc. And so, even from this unfortunate modernist, he is also showing that it's an error to believe that the delay in baptizing catechumens, which arose in some places, was because the church held that they could be saved without it. Even he doesn't argue that. And expanding on this point, he makes the very interesting point that this delay was also to be found with baptizing infants. And on that same page and then the following pages, he says, even in the 4th century, St. Gregory Nazianzen, St. Basil, and St. Augustine, having Christian mothers, still were not baptized till they were adults. Okay, so he points out that these saints, even though they had Christian mothers, were not baptized till they grew up. Well, was that the apostolic tradition? That infants don't need to be baptized, or that they can be saved without it? Obviously not. It's a dogma that they can't be saved without it, and that they should be baptized. But that wasn't observed in all places, and these saints had parents who did not do that. And he goes on about this. It's very interesting. He goes on to talk about, page 128, St. Augustine's mother, who herself is a saint, was a Christian when St. Augustine was born, though his father was not. Immediately on his birth, he was made a catechumen. In his childhood, he fell ill and asked for baptism. His mother was alarmed, and taking measures for his reception into the church, when he suddenly got better, it was deferred, meaning the baptism. So he wasn't baptized as an infant, but when there was a fear that he might die in childhood, measures were taken to baptize him, but he got better, and it was deferred. And so the point here is that practices that might have arisen in certain sectors of the church, or even have been held by certain Christians, were not necessarily representative of the apostolic faith or the teaching of the universal church. That's why Christ founded a church upon St. Peter, so that he could rule the church, guide it, issue authoritative judgments, and sift through some of the false practices which arose in certain areas of the church. And so the point again here is, how mistaken are those who think that because a theologian might have taught that, or because there's one statement from a father, or a few statements from fathers, etc., that necessarily represents the teaching of the church, and they dismiss the authoritative teaching of the papal office. It's just another interesting example of how clearly they err. And he goes on to talk about this, in like manner St. Ambrose, then brought up by his mother and holy nuns, one of them, his own sister, St. Marcellina, was not baptized till he was chosen bishop at the age of about 34. Nor his brother, St. Satyrus, till about the same age, and after the serious warning of a shipwreck. St. Jerome, though educated at Rome and so far under religious influences, was not baptized till he had reached man's estate and had traveled. End quote. And so that's very interesting. Another interesting quote that I think is worth mentioning from this book comes on page 297 and 298. He's talking about the teaching of heretics. He's speaking of how there's some controversy about what a certain Monophysite believed, and he says that this controversy has arisen, quote, partly from confusion between him and his successors, partly from the indecision or the ambiguity which commonly attaches to the professions of heretics, end quote. And so, he's actually speaking about the notorious heretic Eutyches. And he says that there's some confusion about what he believes, partly because of the ambiguity which is common to the profession of heretics. Again, showing that the truth that heretics always use ambiguity. They always contradict themselves because they're lying. And so, when people lie, there isn't consistency. Even in their lies, there won't be consistency. And so, of course, they're going to contradict themselves. And so it just shows the folly, the diabolical folly, of the people who will justify these notorious heretics if they say a few true or conservative things, even though they deny Catholic dogma the rest of the time. It's ridiculous. It's just a small example of that. And so in the next part, I will continue with some more interesting things that... And so, continuing with the review of Cardinal John Henry Newman's book, An Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine, the positive and interesting points as well as the points that are unfortunately incompatible with Catholic teaching. On page 267, there is an interesting quote concerning jurisdiction. He says, quote, "The great Athanasius, as he returned from his exile, made no scruple to ordain in several cities as he went along, though they were not in his own diocese. And the famous Eusebius of Samosata did the like in the times of the Arian persecution under Valens. Epiphanius made use of the same power and privilege in a like case, ordaining Paulianus, St. Jerome's brother, first deacon and then presbyter, in a monastery out of his own diocese in Palestine." End quote. Now, he wasn't really discussing jurisdiction, but this, quote, pertains to it because it shows how in different cases in the early church, bishops would ordain people outside their own diocese if situations arose where there was a necessity, showing that the lines of normal jurisdictional authority weren't always observed because they are church laws which are meant for normal times, as our audios on jurisdiction on our website explain. So this is just another example of supplied jurisdiction and activities that are licit in certain circumstances that normally wouldn't be recommended. So I thought that was interesting about consecrations and ordinations without normal approval or not necessarily in the normal channels or a person's normal jurisdictional area. Another interesting point that he makes concerns refuting Eastern, quote, orthodoxy. And it's essentially an expansion of the same point that many people who have discussed or dealt with this issue have made, but he really adds a lot to it and makes the point quite well. It concerns the famous council that took place in the year 449. It was called Ephesus II. This is actually a notorious council because it's known as a robber council. It was a false council held, which taught the Monophysite heresy that Christ had only one nature, and it absolved the heretic Eutyches, who was a Monophysite. But this is so interesting because this council was approved by many bishops. It swayed many in the East. Okay, and so if the, quote, Orthodox don't accept the papal primacy as the final arbiter of what is a binding council, then by what authority do they separate the true councils from the false councils? Because many bishops have been at true councils, which turned out to be dogmatic, binding, and universal and ecumenical, and many bishops were at false councils with a comparable number of bishops, etc. So how do you differentiate? It's completely arbitrary. That's why we've pointed out that Eastern Orthodoxy is fundamentally illogical. But he really expands upon this point in the case of the false council of Ephesus II, explaining how widespread its acceptance was, especially in the East. He says, this is from page 305, quote, "It is true that the whole number of signatures now extant, 108, may seem small out of 1,000, the number of sees in the East, but the attendance of councils always bore a representative character. The whole number of East and West was about 1,800, yet the second ecumenical council was attended by only 150, which is but a 12th part of the whole number. The third council by about 200, or a ninth. The Council of Nicaea itself numbered only 318 bishops." And let me just interject, he's explaining how the first three ecumenical councils, which even the, quote, Orthodox accept as binding, didn't have that many bishops, okay? And so he's saying that if you're going to go by the number of bishops, you have a problem. He's developing that. And then he's talking about this Ephesus II council. And speaking of Ephesus II, he says, quote, "Moreover, when we look through the names subscribed to the synodal decision, we find that the misbelief or misapprehension or weakness to which this great offense," meaning accepting the council, must be attributed was no local phenomenon, but the unanimous sin of bishops in every patriarchate and of every school of the East. Three out of the four patriarchs were in favor of the heresiarch, meaning Eutyches, the fourth being on his trial. And so he's saying three out of four of the patriarchs in the East accepted the heretic, the Monophysite heretic. And he goes on the next page, even the sees under the influence of Constantinople, which was the remaining sixth division of the East, took part with Eutyches. We find among the signatures to his acquittal the bishops of, and he goes through a list of bishops. And in conclusion, he says, such was the state of Eastern Christendom in the year 449. If the East could determine a matter of faith independently of the West, certainly the Monophysite heresy was established as apostolic truth in all its provinces from Macedonia to Egypt. End quote. And so what he's saying is that if the East could ever set forth the apostolic faith in a binding fashion, how is it not done at Ephesus II with all of this agreement and support behind this heretical council and in favor of this heretic? And this again illuminates the truth that Christ founded the church upon St. Peter. There is a supreme bishop among the bishops, and that gives the true church, the Catholic Church, a logical framework by which it can differentiate between the true councils and the false councils, which ones are binding, which ones aren't. Whereas if you reject that all the bishops are equal, what do you pick, a certain number? It has to be 110? Well, whatever number you pick, you're going to have examples which show that there were false councils, or you will exclude true councils. And so it's a good illustration of the falsity of Eastern so-called orthodoxy. On page, moving on here, 269, there's some interesting quotes about how the fathers regarded heresy, how with what seriousness they regarded the evil of heresy. There's an interesting quote from St. Cyril, which he cites, and it says, quote, "Let us hate them who are worthy of hatred. Withdraw we from those whom God withdraws from. Let us also say unto God with all boldness concerning all heretics, Do I not hate them, O Lord, that hate thee?" End quote. But I found that quote interesting because it really shows how foreign to the apostolic faith is the Vatican II apostate theology and this false ecumenism, whereby heresy is accepted, heretics are accepted. And the truth is, we love all men in the sense that we desire their conversion. But in the sense that St. Cyril is talking about hating heretics, he's talking about hating them as they are, and with a true opposition and hatred for evil. That does not mean that we do not desire their eternal good. Of course, in true charity, we want them to be eternally happy, which will only happen by their conversion. But as they are enemies of God and enemies of Christ. And that's the sentiment he's expressing in that quote. And if a person loves the truth and encounters people who are thoroughly of bad will, one can feel the same exact sentiment that he expresses. Oh, on that same point, on page 264, there's an interesting quote from St. Augustine. Speaking of the different sects, he says, "They do not communicate with us, as you say, Novatians, Arians, Patripassians, Valentinians, Patricians, Apolites, Marcionites, Orphites, and the rest of those sacrilegious names, as you call them, of nefarious pests rather than sects." End quote. So he calls them nefarious pests. So I've discussed some of the positive points in his book, some of the interesting quotes that can be found in his work. Now I must move to the main doctrinal poison that is found throughout his essay on the development of Christian doctrine, and that's the idea that doctrine grows and expands and develops. This is a key modernist concept. And when people are discussing this, there's a fine line between properly explaining what the church teaches on a more precise understanding of the same truth and the heretical evolution of dogma or development of doctrine. And unfortunately, Newman does not adhere to a Catholic line on this. But in the process of trying to explain it and teach it, He expresses a clearly un-Catholic understanding of this issue, which has done much evil and served as a foundation for modernist thought, unfortunately. I will be covering more of this in the future parts, but in this part I want to cover one of the main expressions of his false doctrine on this issue. On page 68 he says, quote, "We shall find ourselves unable to fix an historical point at which the growth of doctrine ceased and the rule of faith was once for all settled, not on the day of Pentecost, for St. Peter had still to learn at Joppa that he was to baptize Cornelius, not at Joppa and Caesarea, for St. Paul had to write his epistles, not on the death of the last apostle, for St. Ignatius had to establish the doctrine of episcopacy." End quote. He says that the rule of faith was not fixed and the growth of doctrine did not cease at the death of the last apostle, but that it grew after that. That is one of the errors precisely condemned by Pope St. Pius X in Lamentabili, the Errors of the Modernists. Number 21 says, quote, "Revelation constituting the object of Catholic faith was not completed with the apostles." Condemned. Denzinger 20, 21,